Welcome to this podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download a copy of this and other Sunday Night pods from our website, abc.net.au/Sundaynights with an S. I hope you enjoy the program.
You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. We've been at the Parliament of the World's Religions, and we've got two guests in the studio this evening who have come to join us, Kyle Ishmael and Ndidi Okapu from the United States, Chicago, I believe. And we know Chicago because Frank Sinatra sang songs about it. That's what Australians know about Chicago. You know? So this is not much. But you come from a sort of rich tradition because you are Muslims living in Chicago, but you also have a black heritage living in Chicago. So we thought it would be great to just sit around for a while, talk about it. If you at home would like to ring up, ask questions of Kyle and Ndidi, please feel free. The number is 1300 222 774. 1300 222 774, here on ABC Radio around Australia. We're also going on Radio Australia across the Pacific. We're on the World Wide Web. If you'd like to stream directly on the web, you can get us. And also on your pod. Well, part of the program, the first 2 hours every night on the pod. If you're looking for us on the ABC website, it's abc.net.au/Sunday Nights. So do have a look and pick up any of the guests we've had this evening in the Parliament of World's Religions from ABC Radio here in Melbourne Live. Kyle and Ndidi, welcome to Sunday Nights. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to have you with us. What brings you here, Ndidi? You're actually writing for a newspaper, aren't you?
I am. I write for Muslim Journal newspaper. Let's see. I'm also here representing Sound Vision Foundation with some of the seminary school training that they're doing. And I'm also particularly here to I presented a workshop on African American Muslims, Mirrors for Global Justice.
It's interesting that these justice themes seem to be emerging. Kyle, you've sort of wandered around looking at the sorts of workshops and themes that are going on. Do you see sort of common strands emerging? Do you see things that are sort of concerns for the Muslim community in the United States beginning to emerge and be seen in not only in other Muslim groups, but across some of the religious traditions you've had a look at?
Yeah, I think, we did, with the World Parliament of Religions, we want to come together and share and educate one another about our faith traditions and how we express it. But we can't be, we can't create an association without making an effort to have some relevance in the world. You know, it can't be feel-good sessions. It can't be sort of insular conversations between religious communities. We have to bring our faith and our ideas to bear some of the problems.
Yeah, and it's the difficult thing is to do that without surrendering the core of your faith tradition, isn't it? Because there's certain things you can't compromise on. You got to say, well, look, this is my faith. This is what I believe. I'm happy to
talk
to you.
So much in common that we haven't even really gotten to the differences. We really, there's so much in common that we share, and that it has relevance to the rest of the world that we have to work on: alleviating poverty, dealing with issues of climate change, dealing with the spread of HIV/AIDS, in other diseases, and just dealing with human suffering and issues of compassion. We all have that in common. So those conversations occupy a lot of space. And really, just today, we just began to start talking about some of the differences, areas of very high sensitivity, like Israel-Palestine, for example.
Yeah, difficult. Well, we're hearing just in Melbourne this evening on the news that there was a demonstration, a Palestinian demonstration at the Israeli embassy, and three people have been arrested. These are common stories you hear all over the place. It's just ironic that it was going on the news just as we were talking about the sort of how you build, begin to build the bridges of reconciliation. We also heard on the news bulletin, just as you were coming into the studio tonight, that even within traditions there's fights, like the Anglicans in the United States, the Episcopalians, have just had another split with an openly gay woman being elected bishop in Los Angeles, I think. So there's going to be another fight. So right. Communities still haven't solved differences even within themselves, have they? That's a
well, I mean, we don't look towards solving big problems that are perennial generational problems like that. You have to have people of faith have to have faith. they have to have patience, and they have to understand that if we can incrementally impact these things within the space of 100 years, then that's enormous progress.
And did you tell me, when you go to a mosque these days, you go to a mosque and you hear the imams teach, are they beginning to get alert to these problems at the local level?
Alert to which problems?
The sorts of things that the parliament is talking about and the things that Kyle's just mentioned, things like the environmental crisis, the sort of the crisis over AIDS, and the way in which local communities need to get active and get involved, begin to think responsibly about the climate, all of that sort of stuff.
I would say, to an extent, definitely. I would say that globalization has caused, I think, all communities, faith communities, cultural communities, ethnic communities, to really re-examine everyone's actual contribution to the global climate. And not just the actual, you know, environmental climate, but political climate, you know, economic climate. More and more, I'm hearing there's in the States, there's this this talk, this phenomenon about civic engagement, about being aware and fully engaging communities outside of your own, from on the local government and political level, and just on like a social level. So
and that's getting talked at down at the level of the local mosque.
Yes.
Because in Christianity, if you go to church in Christianity, you might find the top level, mm-hmm. you know, the bishops and others and some of the priests will talk about this stuff, but it's very hard to get it down really grounded at the local level because local people say, oh, they're not my concerns. It's somebody else's business.
I would characterize it quite the opposite. I think the people oftentimes have religious leadership on these issues.
Right.
I think that a lot of times people, they don't want to wait to build consensus with religious leaders, because that's a slower process at times than what we want to wait for when we see circumstances becoming bad.
Yeah, that mass movement can actually grassroots. Move from the bottom, grassroots.
Yeah, grassroots.
And I just wanted to touch on something that you had mentioned earlier in terms of the whole interreligious dialogue to the extent where, but not too much pushing because you don't want to cross anybody's barriers on their beliefs or whatever. I guess I just wanted to touch on that because we're doing this program with the seminary students about educating leaders for multi-religious leadership and dialogue. And one of the things that, you know, I think my particular breakout group was talking about is that you have to kind of allow yourself to be a little bit vulnerable, but I think the trick is to be comfortable and secure in your own faith.
Yeah.
I feel like when you're secure in your own faith, then you can do nothing but learn and benefit from studying others.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. Two of the delegates for the Parliament of World Religions, also journalists for Muslim newspapers in the United States, Kyle Ismail and Ndidi Okapu, our guests on Sunday night around Australia. If you'd like to give us a call, join the conversation, 1-300-222-774. Now, that's not our normal number. We're coming live out of Melbourne rather than Sydney tonight, so do write the number down, give us a call, 1-300-222-774. Let's just take one call for the moment, and it's from Noel. Noel wants to make an observation. Noel, I believe it's about religions, in your view, are agents for division rather than unity. Do you want to spell that out a bit for us?
Yes, well, we'll start with the... hello there, friends.
Hello.
We'll start with the great Akbar, or Akbar the Great, In India, they had peace between the Muslims and the Hindus when he was in power. He claimed that it was a wise man that never put his faith above all others. Now, it's not many years ago that if you were a Catholic or a Protestant, you could only get a job in a Catholic establishment if you were a Catholic, or vice versa for the Protestants. I still think they're a great divider. And that appears to me that this business going on in the Middle East is another crusade, like the old crusades. You've got all these nations teaming up and going into the Middle East where we don't apparently appear to be wanted. And I think even the Muslim religion, all religions have extremists in them, which could create a great deal of trouble. I'll leave my case there and go back to bed.
Noel, thanks for your observations, and we'll chew that around a bit. You want to stay on the line, you can, but if you want to slip off to bed and just listen to the way we handle it, you're welcome to do that
too. I want to ask Noel a question, though.
Yeah.
So what would you recommend if religion is divisive? Then what is the alternative?
Come again?
I said, if you feel religion is divisive, what are you offering as an alternative?
Well, it is a divider, but a lot of people take things too serious, and there's great extremists in all religions, and they say, mine's right, yours wrong, boom, boom. How about that?
Yeah, but you could say there's that secular beliefs are just as divisive. I mean, communism was pretty divisive. Fascism was pretty divisive. You didn't believe in what Adolf said, you were put in a concentration camp and done away with. I mean, surely it's a case of the way people believe, not particularly what they believe. Although what they believe is important, but it's the attitude they carry with those beliefs, isn't it?
They all strive for God, and most religions practice, or supposedly practice, compassion. You know, Christian religion, the Muslim religion. Muhammad was a compassionate man and a fair man, and you'll find the same amongst the Christians. But the trouble still seems to pop up, and refugees are fleeing from one country to another, and I'd say it's a case of overpopulation. And religion seemed to be like a tribal sort of a system.
Noel, thanks for your observations. We'll chew on those matters that you've brought up. Let's pick up on one or two of the questions, Kyle. Noel has reflected what a lot of people generally think about religion, and to be fair, religions do have their extreme elements, and from time to time when people are under social stress, I guess, those extreme elements come forward. The other argument, of course, is it's the social stresses that cause people to become extreme, not the religion. So how do you respond to that?
Well, Noel is correct to some extent, and that is because the way that people engage religion is self-serving at times, which instead of God-serving, and people use religion as a crutch.
Yeah, look at Northern Ireland for years.
Exactly. People use religion as justification. People use religion really as a divisive matter. It is true at times. But what interfaith work, dialogue, and conversation has allows religious people to do is to really re-engage religion in the right way, so that no matter what it is we believe, it gives us a platform to really engage those beliefs in a way that helps us to evolve ourselves and understand our belief systems more deeply, so that the type of engagement with religion that Noel described is not something that we will ourselves carry out. However, you know, there is a relationship, you know, with religion and politics, and you know, and that is a major piece of what he was talking about. Religion as politics is really what he described. And when you have autocratic regimes that use religion to control their populace,
or a political vision that uses religion,
exactly.
Yeah.
And in my own country, the United States, religion is a tremendous wedge issue. You talked about the Anglican situation with someone who's openly gay being elected to a high position. It's a very divisive wedge issue.
It's a culture war issue.
In American politics, yeah. No question about it. A whole set of factors can be determined along the lines of politics because people refuse to see in a more nuanced fashion through how people who want to divide can use it.
Sex is a bit like race in that way, isn't it? Like, you go back a couple of generations in the United States, sex and race were linked because you didn't intermarry a colour. That was called miscegenation, black and right. whites marrying. And it became a religious issue. It became a sin under that term, miscegenation. And yet, really, the tradition moves on, and all of a sudden, oh, no, we're wrong about that, folks. We were misusing our tradition. The misuse of tradition is, as I guess, what people exploit and what people are concerned about. Why do you hang on to your tradition, Ndidi?
Why do I hang on to my...
tradition, your Muslim faith. Why do you hang on to it?
Because for me, it is a complete way of life. I mean, that's the best answer I can give. It makes sense for me, for my spirit and my soul, my well-being, my daily living. So,
Kyle, what is it for you?
I think our lives are about growth and transformation, and for me, that's what Islam has meant. It has meant it has provided me an opportunity to know the most outstanding individuals.
Did you grow up in the faith, or did you convert to it?
As a college student.
Converted as a college student. What about you, Ndidi?
I was raised in religion.
Yeah. Because often you'll find people who have come late to a religion, mm-hmm. or their families don't necessarily follow the same religious tradition, mm-hmm. Are more serious, because they have to be more intentional. Whereas if you grow up in a family with religion, well, you just wear it like a piece of... like clothes.
Absolutely. Actually, you know, I've always said that and regardless of what faith tradition you follow, it always comes a time in a person's life where they have to choose that religion for themselves. It's not I'm Christian because my family is Christian, or I'm Muslim because my family is Muslim. But I think it comes an age of responsibility where you decide that this is or is not the faith tradition that you wish to practice. And, you know, Kyle had that breakthrough in college, and I think I had mine I think it was a little bit after about 17 I did a year in Syria, and I think after my experience there I decided this is, you know, I'm gonna do it 100%.
Are your family American?
My mother is African American, my father's Nigerian.
Did you spend any time in Nigeria?
I've been to Nigeria, yeah.
Now, there's an experience that's a tough one.
Yeah, it's interesting dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, again, religion's a fissure point in Nigeria, north and south.
Well, religion and then tribalism. Yeah. So it's there. You know, there's still a lot of damage left from colonialism, and which kind of affected how the religious sects, you know, get along.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio. We're taking your calls. Join the chat room around the country. Let's pick up on another thread. Sid wants to ask a question, and it's around the Islamic faith, around the Quran, in fact. Sid, welcome to the program. How are you doing? Sid, you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. What would you like to ask or say?
I'm sorry about that. The line's very faint.
Yes, it is. A very scratchy line. But what is it you'd like to say?
Look, I guess my question really goes to Noel's question. The thing that really worries me or confuses me is the, the fundamentalism or the martyrism, you know, to be a martyr. And I'm not only talking about the Muslim religion, and I know that there's fundamentalism in nearly all religion. But what I don't understand is the mindset of what it is to be a martyr, and why does it happen?
Well, I'm not sure that any of us can give you an adequate answer, but we'll try.
I've not been a martyr yet, so I'm not quite certain, but I do understand Sid's concern.
And it's not on your list as a
It's definitely not on my
favorite
list.
Favorite things you wish to do.
Two things. In fact, in the multi-religious leadership program we were having today, it was really interesting. The imam had mentioned that in terms of religion and holy wars and things like that, he was saying what's currently going on in Iraq, he asked how many people actually believe that that's a holy war, that it's about religion, that the war is about religion.
Afghanistan or Iraq?
I think it was about Iraq specifically. And he's like, how many people really believe that that's about religion? And nobody raised their hand. Because clearly there's like a lot of political, you know, oil
yes.
considerations, you know.
And, yeah, tribal tensions between the Pashtuns and the others. And
that people are able to capitalize on, to be quite honest with you. So there's a lot of, I wanted to touch on that because that was mentioned before about holy wars and crusades and things like that. On the flip side, in regards to the question just asked, I think that people who feel desperate do desperate things. And I'm not by any way condoning anyone's actions, but I feel that when people, if you look at the crime that one commits, you kind of need to look at what is motivating it. And so I think that's one thing to take into consideration. But most of the Muslim world does not agree with suicide bombings and terrorism. And like the gentleman said before, that extremism comes in every, you know, faith tradition. Like we had the David Koresh and the Timothy McVeigh from the Christian.
The extreme Christian anti-abortionists bombing abortion clinics.
And I guess they must have felt desperate to get their word out. So, I mean, that's the only thing that I can kind of figure.
Yes, you're looking at a psychosis. You're not looking necessarily at a sort of political movement. You're looking at individuals. You're looking at sort of ideologies. It's a question of religions being used and misused, I guess. Kyle?
And when we look at fundamentalism and people using religion as a justification or to kill, we should really not be so quick to come to conclusions based on what we see on the surface. When we, as an American, I have a professor of Islamic studies who posed this question to us. He said, if we had turned on the television one day and we see that in America it happens that an African-American Muslim drives a vehicle full of explosives into the headquarters of the KKK and leaves a note and sends it to the radio and TV station saying, I'm going to kill them because they are infidel Christians, and it is my Muslim duty to do this, as quoted in the Quran, chapter, verse, such and such. Would we believe that? Would we accept that on face value? And the answer to that is we wouldn't accept that on face value. Why? Because we have what we call social and historical memory and understand context. And so if we see someone who's black attack the KKK, we have historical memory and context to know that it's probably not deeply psychologically motivated by the difference in religion. It's probably deeply motivated by a history of mistreatment, abuse, psychopathic behavior on behalf of the KKK, and really terrorism on behalf of the KKK. It is that kind of context and history and historical memory that informs how we interpret and make assumptions. Yes. So when we see, and we're looking at a society whose history we don't know, whose social context and dynamics we don't know, we should feel the inclination to want to know context and understanding and the things that undergird motivation and psychology. Because just to understand it with a broad brush, oh, it's the Muslims, you know how they are. Then that means that we're willing to have simplistic answers on matters that we would not accept for ourselves.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia and via the web to the world. You can pick up this program if you want to stream it on your computer. We're streaming across the USA at the moment. One of the groups that we heard perform yesterday, we're going to take a little listen to them. And don't go away, folks. You're still on the line, but we are going to play a little musical interlude in a moment. Look, I think we'll take one caller more before we have our musical interlude. Either of you guys hear the Agape Choir yesterday, the gospel choir?
I didn't hear them yesterday, but I've heard them in the past.
They were pretty good. So we got a live recording for a few minutes of those. We're going to play in a moment. If you want to give us a call, 1-300-222-774. But one more call from Ken first. Hi, Ken. How are you? What would you like to say?
Trying not to be quite so controversial this week, if you like. I'm wondering if the black Muslim movement or black Muslim community will ever feel accepted in America without having to change in some way towards the mainstream America. I say that because the Americans seem to have the ability to adjust, like the Catholic changing their belief systems to an American sort of Catholicism. The Church of England's changing with the female bishops and all that sort of thing. Is it possible the Muslim faith can change in some way, or will it change in some way, to be accepted? And do you think that's likely to happen in America?
It's a very interesting question, that, because all religious traditions are dynamic to some extent. All religious traditions do have the capacity to change, and the extent to which they get wrapped up in the new cultures that they go into, sometimes they're blamed for it by the purists, and sometimes they're told they don't adapt quickly enough. How do you feel?
When you say Black Muslim movement...
Yeah, let's straighten that one out,
yeah,
shall we? Because that's a question we need to actually...
Are you talking about a specific community?
No, I'm just talking generally about... Well, at the moment, I can imagine Black Americans are just starting to become acceptable because of the 100 years ago they fought a war over getting rid of slavery, thank God. And it's taken all that time for people to get over the emotional differences between slave and master. And the Muslim part of the faith, where a lot of people seem to think that we're at war with the Muslim faith, which we're not. We're at war with extremism, and most Muslims aren't. Most Muslims tend to, my understanding, fit into the community and follow the rules of the community in which they live. So it's not an actual movement or anything like that. It's just a general theme of being Black and Muslim at the moment is something that is quite different from mainstream America, put it that way.
Okay. So your question is, do you think that these communities will be able to fully integrate into society? Is that what your question is?
Do you think you'll have to adjust in your faith, your own just the colour of your skin, or I suppose if you're blending in half black, half white parents and that sort of thing, I suppose it's sort of everybody comes a shade of grey and that'd be fantastic. But the religious part can blend. Do you think it wise that you do, and is it Muslim faith able to do that in a modern American society in order to fit in and be acceptable?
I want to say that one of the great dynamics about African American Muslims has been, and I might be biased.
You're allowed to be.
I'm allowed to be a little biased. I'm going to be biased.
Support your own team.
I'm just saying. But one of the things, okay, I'm going to speak an I statement. I feel that one of the great things about African American Muslims is that a lot of us have been able to have had to forge our own Islamic identity and have been able to maintain that and are quite proud of it. And so here's the thing. I'm going to touch on two things. African American Muslims, very just like African American Christians, just like there are millions of denominations within Christianity, there's a lot of denominations and associations within America and of African Americans who practice different their faith in different ways. The community I'm from, with Imam Warthi Muhammad, the late leader, Imam Warthi Muhammad, we've had to forge our own identity as African Americans, and most importantly, our own identity as Muslims. And I don't think that we have to compromise, because we understand that that Islam gives us a citizenship to the world, gives us global citizenship. And that global citizenship also reaches inwardly to our national heritage as Americans. So we are American citizens, we are global citizens, and we don't feel the need to compromise either. And we were talking about it in the presentation yesterday, that when Imam Warthi Muhammad came into office, he came in and he was moving the people out of the Nation of Islam and moving them towards Orthodox Islam. And he came in there, he's saying, with the American flag, and he said, if you won't carry this, I will. You know, because, you know, Islam actually, what do you always say, Kyle? It's that your culture, your customs has a weight within religion. So we also have to respect the law of the land that we're in. And, you know, our Islamic teachings tell us to be pretty much, instructs us to be good citizens. So I don't think we have to compromise because it's inherent pluralism within Islam.
Ken, thanks for your call. Very good of you. Let's clear up the point you alluded to there too, indeed, and that is the connection with historically with the Nation of Islam, which emerged as a really distinct movement about 100 years ago, or just under 100 years ago, didn't it? And that's moving back into mainstream Islam, mainly into the Sunni tradition in the United States. Mm-hmm. Do you want to explain that just to us a little bit about Elijah Muhammad and what all that was about?
Well, Honorable Elijah Muhammad, around, I guess, the 1930s, had started to, it was a poor black man from the South, you know, under such negative conditions, lynching, cross burning, you know, African Americans were 1 foot out of slavery and 2 feet into indentured servitude, you know, had heard the rumblings of this new religion, this Islam religion that empowered black people, that told you black man is God, that told you that you should aspire to be more than, you know, chattel, you know what I'm saying?
The message was one of liberation.
Right. You can call it black nationalism, you can call it radicalism, or whatever the case may be. But really what it did was it was designed to empower a people who were oppressed.
And in that sense, it gained its own little eccentricities along the way.
It did. And it was a mixture of some of the best, some tenets of Islam, some tenets of nationalism, some tenets of radicalism. It was a mixture of different things. And what eventually happened was, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad began to study Islam more, he did realize, you know, we kind of need to, you know, that there's a little bit more out there. So what eventually happened, his son, Wallace or Warthdeen Muhammad, you know, as a child, he understood where his father was going, but he just couldn't reconcile the nationalism and the, you know, just certain concepts that just didn't stick with actual Quranic doctrine. And so he began to study, and he decided to study Islam orthodox, so to speak, mainstream, from the Quran, as told by the Quran or whatever. And I guess the rest is history. In about 1975, he was chosen, he was voted in to take leadership. And basically, what he came with was Quran as the doctrine, as the universal doctrine that's used by millions of Muslims worldwide. The remnants, I suppose, of the Nation of Islam, I think Farrakhan, a lot of you are probably familiar with Minister Louis Farrakhan, he then took over and, you know, continued with the traditions of old. And I want to say Imam Warthdeen Muhammad is responsible for taking hundreds of thousands of Muslims into returning them to their original...
to the mainstream.
Absolutely.
And Farrakhan maintained a very strong... very strong line for some that was necessary to preserve the edge of his social justice thing, wasn't it? I mean, he kept the Nation of Islam because he actually felt very strongly about its contribution to the justice issue of
and the Nation
Islam.
Of Islam has made a lot of contributions to the issue of social justice.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio. Our guests, Kyle Ishmael and Ndidi Okapu. And we're talking to you, taking your calls. We're going to break down and have a listen to some music. Don't go away. This is wonderful. This is the Agape Gospel Choir. And Let Me Love in a Holy, Holy Way.
Is all around. ABC Grandstand presents Great Sporting Songs and Anthems, a double album featuring the music that has inspired champions and
Hi, Rod Quinn here from The Overnight Show with some great news. Now you can enjoy overnights at any time of the day. Just go to our website, abc.net.au/overnights, to hear the best of our interviews, to meet our regular guests and experts, or to leave a comment of your own. So tune into Overnights, live at night or online at any time, at abc.net.au/overnights.
On Sunday night on ABC Radio, our guests are Ndidi Okapu and Kyle Ishmael from Chicago in the United States, Muslim journalists covering the Parliament of the World's Religions, and we're taking your calls. George, what is it that you'd like to ask?
Yes, my question actually relates to Muhammad. Something that I've never actually sort of seen anywhere what religion that Muhammad the Prophet was actually brought up in and surrounded by, because obviously there must have been some kind of religion, I imagine. Was it a Christian religion or some kind of Judeo-Christian offshoot? Or because obviously the ideas of Islam, development of the Judeo-Christian Abrahamic, I mean, often American politicians, as we know, talk about, you know, us all being people of the book and trying to bring us all together. So I'm just wondering if they would comment on their understanding of the history of how Muhammad developed his religious beliefs and the surroundings, the religious groups that were around him at the time.
Muhammad before the revelation.
Mm-hmm. Muhammad the Prophet, prayers and peace be upon him, believed in the one God, you know? And so we understand that as him being Muslim, but clearly not what you would say officially, or we understand that as him being Muslim, but clearly not what you would say officially, or, you know, it was before, like you said, before the revelation. But we believe that he believed in the same one God that that Abraham believed in. So that's, I mean, there was, during the time of him growing up, there were a lot of idolatry. There was a lot of idolatry and pagan beliefs, and he was one of a few who believed in the concept of there being one God, and that was one of the reasons why he was so, you know, prime for the revelation. And so in a sense, he was always Muslim.
So the broad culture in which he grew up was essentially It wasn't Christian. It wasn't Jewish. It was essentially the local pagan culture.
The local pagan culture.
Him.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Kyle, do you have anything to add to that?
I would characterize it as institutionalized pagan culture, because it was pagan culture that was really enshrined in a religious temple that we believe was built by Abraham to worship for the worship of God. And what the Arabs had done was they had filled that temple with idols. And the city of Mecca, where this resides, was the mother city for trading purposes. And so all the pagan tribes around would come and bring their idols into that temple. So it wasn't just idolatry and pagan worship. It was institutionalized idolatry and pagan worship. And it was also the place that was a center of trading and culture for the Arabs. So that's why I would emphasize that it was that. Now, after the Quran was revealed to the Prophet, he moved to a city called Medina, which is where his community really flourished and grew and developed, where they were in contact with Christians and Jews and had diplomatic relationships and pacts and agreements and treaties with them as well.
Thanks for your question, George.
Can I just make one more comment, John?
Sure.
It's just, I mean, obviously know that after the revelation and after Muhammad's death, there was a split very soon after the Shias and Sunnis. So obviously there are two mainstream arms to Islam. But in terms of a vision I've always had about how to bring the people of the book together, in terms the Dome of the Rock is a very contentious area, but it's also the site of it's a very holy spot for Judaism and for Islam and for Christianity. And I've always thought, rather than have a disputed territory about who actually has primacy over it, I'd love to see maybe a Christian a cathedral and maybe a Jewish temple, which is what they've always wanted, maybe built under the Dome of the Rock and have a, like a Holy Trinity built on each other.
One cannot heresy.
The other.
Well, you can only hope, George. We can only hope. But I think that's a long way down the path of reconciliation.
Yeah, but it's a nice vision.
It is a nice vision. Good on you. Thanks for your call. Time for one brief call from Bill. Bill, I have to make it short. Sorry. Bill, you there?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, you'll have to make it short, Bill.
Okay, just as most Australians, we don't really know or understand the Islamic religion in its main beliefs. So just wondering if your guest could outline what the main fundamentals of Mohammedism or Islam are, because most of us don't really know. We have all these things about 26 virgins if you die
from
all this stuff or whatever it is.
Okay. Look, I'm going to have to cut you off there, Bill, but we'll get the 30-second version. I mean, some people will say Islam submission.
I'll give you five pillars really quickly because we're under the gun. One, belief in God. Two, prayer. Three, fasting. Four, charity. And five, pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca. But the thing is, the word Islam means peace, and it's the concept is to submit to the one God. I guess that's the 30-second version.
Indeedy, and Kyle, it's been great to have you with
it's
us
been
on
pleasure.
Sunday night. My thanks to Michael Pavlich and Noel DeBean, who've worked so hard to put this program together. To all those at the Parliament of World Religions who've helped out, you've heard a long list during the night. We've had a great time. Good night to you all. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.